I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
He kōna e purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Voice of Tangaroa is a collaboration between New Zealand Geographic and RNZ. Reporting for this series is public interest journalism funded through New Zealand On Air.
That's really, really hard to manage it appropriately because it's land, sea, it's different user groups, it's rights, it's things like the settlement, it's like people not understanding each other's points of view. And really when it all comes down to it, it's not about us, it's about what's in the water.
Kia ora anō, welcome back to Voice of Tangaroa.
Ko Kate Evans aho. I'm a science journalist that often writes for New Zealand Geographic.
Ko Clecken Cannon tēnei. I make a weekly science podcast for RNZ called Our Changing World. And today we're talking marine reserves, which is a totally easy, non-complicated, non-contentious topic. Right, Kate? Right?
Nope, not even close. There are a lot of different opinions, traditions, economic conflicts, and feelings that are brought to the surface when you mention marine reserves. New Zealand once led the world in marine protection, and despite the fact that we signed up to an international goal to protect 30% of our vast ocean areas by 2030, we currently protect less than 0.5%. And any new proposals tend to face major pushback that delays the process for years, even decades.
8 years on from its inception, the long-contested Kermadec Ocean Sanctuary is now dead in the water.
I wanted to investigate how marine protection in Aotearoa became so politically fraught, and whether there's a way to better work together to help our ocean ecosystems. What I can say for certain, my totally non-contentious opinion, is that our marine reserves are an absolute pleasure to dive at or snorkel in.
There was that huge cloud of two-spot demoiselles sort of swimming
around. To start with, all those stingrays flying past, a lot of them.
Quentin Bennett and I are standing on the deck of a boat off the Poor Knights Island, and we're recalling our dive just that morning.
Yeah, I love seeing how they were like in three dimensions. There was one cruising right over our heads, and then there was another one just below us in different directions.
Some sunning themselves, sleeping in little breaks in the kelp.
Yeah.
Sounds like a fun time.
It was amazing. From the moment my head dipped below the water, I just saw fish in every direction. This place is teeming with diversity and life. Parori and snapper, shimmering blue and pink mau mau, elegant black angelfish, an abundant kelp forest, and a stripy fish hiding in the weeds providing a cleaning service to other fish. It's my first time diving here. Not so for Quentin, who has heaps of stories.
Wade Doak and I had an incident where we saw this enormous great shark. Not sure whether it was just what we call a mega mako, really big female mako, or whether it was a great white. We'd already seen a bronze whaler on that dive. But bronze whaler sharks are coming back in, which is good. And people say, oh, how can you dive with sharks? And I always say to them, when you've seen a shark, you'll realise how beautiful they are. In actual fact, they're very shy. And it's very hard to photograph sharks to get close enough to them because they're frightened of us, very wisely.
Wade Doak, like Quentin himself, was one of the early pioneers of diving in Aotearoa. Quentin's in his early 80s now, but he started diving as a teenager, and he first dived at the Poor Knights in the 1960s. It was different back then, he says. More sharks, bigger kingfish, larger schools of trevally, and you could easily find harpooka and bluefish. Sometimes on dives they would come across new species no one had even seen before. You could also fish there.
We would often just catch a pink mau mau or a trevally and fillet it and eat it with bread and butter. We'd bring bread and butter with us and eat that and perhaps even have a, have a little bit of wine with it.
The Poor Knights was given some protection in 1981 and full protection as a marine reserve in 1998. But it wasn't the first. That was the Goat Island Marine Reserve in Lee, where I grew up, where my dad taught me to snorkel, and probably the place where I first fell in love with the ocean and its creatures. The phosphorescence at night, the sea hares and nudibranchs, and this one big old snapper that always had a rusty hook caught through its mouth like a punk with a lip piercing. Quentin was part of the group involved in pushing for this, as were Wade Doak and Bill Ballantyne, the director of the University of Auckland's Lee Marine Laboratory at the time.
And we lobbied for a marine reserve at Goat Island, and got it. And that was the first marine reserve in the world. And Bill Ballantyne became the sort of guru of marine reserves around the world. And he was quite some character, frightened of absolutely no one. He was an Englishman, and he made his mark worldwide. And I feel a little bit ashamed in that we're New Zealand is now trailing. We started this, and we're trailing a bit. We need to be having more marine reserves.
The government of the day wasn't really interested and had the temerity to say there was no such legislation.
This is Bill Ballantyne speaking to former RNZ presenter Dean Williams in 2007.
And that annoyed us, so we went public on the issue and demanded that some legislation be created.
This led to the Marine Reserves Act in 1971 and to the establishment of the first no-take marine reserve at Goat Island in 1975. 5 square kilometres from Cape Rodney to Okakari Point.
The man who lived at the farmhouse up there, Roddy Matheson, he was the key man in stiffening my spine when practically everybody was deserting on the issue of could you fish off the rocks. I went to see Roddy, who'd lived here all his life, and he was never one for a quick answer, so he rolled a cigarette and discussed his grandchildren and the growth of grass. And finally, as I got up to go, he said, used to be very different round here. I'd like my grandchildren to see what it was like. And that was enough. I went away and kept going until they finally gave in. So we got a reserve that was no take, no disturbance. And that was a very new idea.
Now we have 44 fully no-take marine reserves scattered around our ocean territory, which might sound like a lot, but most of them are very small. It adds up to that less than 0.5% of New Zealand waters under full protection. 6 new reserves are due to come into effect mid this year, but they're the first in a decade and will only increase that tally by 0.01%. And so the question that kept coming up in my reporting is, when it comes to marine reserves in New Zealand, is it time now for some more new ideas?
Why, do marine reserves not work? What happens when you section off a piece of ocean like this?
If the reserve is the right size and location, and fishing is the issue, then they do work. Studies in New Zealand and overseas have shown that marine reserves have greater biodiversity, larger fish, and can act as a kind of fish production line for surrounding areas. I read heaps of research about this and summarised it in an article I wrote for New Zealand Geographic. But the take-home message is that reserves seem to not just enable fish inside the protected area to flourish, but they also improve fishing and ecosystems nearby. Essentially, the big old fish in the reserve produce loads of eggs and larvae, which help to replenish surrounding areas. And some adults decide to just swim out as well. It all results in more and bigger fish that are easier to catch for recreational and commercial fishers. A paper published just this year looked through all the research on marine protected areas in 25 countries and found multiple benefits to fisheries and tourism and no evidence of decreased catch anywhere.
That's quite a finding. And marine protected areas is a term for parts of the ocean around the world where protection methods are used, which can mean different things in different places. In Aotearoa, New Zealand, there are 2 types of marine protection areas. Type 1 is no-touch, no-take marine reserves, which is what we're focused on today. But then Type 2 areas also have some protections from fishing. Then there are protection tools like customary management reserves, marine mammal sanctuaries, and seafloor protection areas. But Kate, what you're saying is that the evidence suggests that marine reserves mean more fish, bigger fish, and fish spilling out into other areas. So what's the problem?
See, you're thinking about this in the wrong way. Fish are great, but this is not really a story about fish. This is a story about politics and legislation, about rights and responsibilities, about history, about the difficulties in understanding each other and coming to agreement.
Ah, okay then.
Well, with that in mind, what are the issues for New Zealand?
Right, so there are a few. First, whenever marine reserves get proposed, there's always pushback from the commercial and recreational fishing lobbies. People want to be able to fish in the places they've always fished.
Gotcha. People's livelihoods, their businesses, how they put kai on the table. That patch moana close to them is important for how they live.
Yeah, there's probably an element of not in my backyard too. The second thing is, the Marine Reserves Act was designed to serve what Bill Ballantyne and co were looking for, a small area of the sea to be set aside to use for scientific study, or to preserve a place because of significant biodiversity or beauty. It's not really designed for what some people hope they can do now, which is more in the fisheries management side of things, protect larger areas of the ocean to allow a space for ecosystem regeneration and for fish stocks to recuperate. Plus, the Marine Reserves Act was written up in 1971, and it doesn't mention the Treaty of Waitangi once.
That does sound like a problem.
Yeah. Article 2 of the treaty actually guarantees Māori full, exclusive and undisturbed possession of their fisheries. But in 1986, the introduction of the quota management system explicitly removed any recognition of Māori customary and commercial rights to fishing, from the exclusive right to everything to absolutely nothing. So after a six-year battle, the 1992 Māori Fisheries Settlement was the attempt to fix this huge breach of the treaty. Māori received $150 million to buy half of Sea Lord and the ability to manage their own customary fisheries. And crucially, iwi received 10% of all the existing quota and the right to 20% of any new fish species brought into the quota management system.
Just explain this to me, Kate. The quota is how much fish you can catch, right?
Yeah, it's the right to harvest fish for sale, a right that you can trade and also lease. It's how our commercial fisheries are managed. There's an annual limit to how much of each species of fish can be caught. Some of this is set aside for recreational and customary fishing. The rest is the total allowable commercial catch, which is divided up among the quota owners. So the more quota you have, the more fish you can catch. So this settlement gave back some of the rights to catch fish to Māori. But in return, Māori gave up their right to any further fisheries claims. So when you create a marine reserve under the 1971 Marine Reserves Act, a no-touch, no-take, in-perpetuity reserve, you essentially trample on these hard-won Māori rights with regards to the ocean.
It compromises the fisheries settlement for our tribe, for our iwi, if we are locked out of it.
This is Brendan Flack.
Ko hika roro te mauka, ko waikawaiti te awa, ko pukitaraki te marae, ko kaitarua heke heke te hapu, ko te tai o arai te uru, te moana. My name is Brendan Flack and I live at a place called Pukitaraki.
Brendan is a tangata tiaki for Pukitaraki Marae in Otago, and he explained to me his thoughts around what you lose when you lock people out of fishing a patch of the ocean forever.
I mean, there'd be a lot of opinions on it, but to me it's about mātauranga. And if you lock up anything or you don't have access to it, you lose the mātauranga. And I think that particularly, you know, for a lot of Māori in the south anyway, you know, we're trying to find some of that lost stuff we had been excluded from. And so, yeah, you lock up a fishery and there's no opportunity to have that mata, you know, to actually experience it for the whole order of the people, for the health of the people, their Māori order. It's really important to be able to do something that your ancestors did. So you can't do that when the fishery's not healthy either. And so there is a time for restoration and then a time for use. Yeah, I guess it's just walking that tightrope and getting it right, but not locking it up for eternity, because eventually this, you know, potentially these protected areas might be the only areas that are actually, you know, abundant. So, you know, that sort of, to me, that it's important that there has to be some opportunity to be able to use that.
Is there also an idea of decisions that we make now affecting our great-grandchildren who aren't here yet and don't have a chance to have a say?
Yeah, exactly. That is super important, and for our, you know, for our
fisheries group, our taiapiri, it's about us and our children after us. So it's crucial. It doesn't mean necessarily that you have to sacrifice everything this generation, but you certainly need to make sure that that resource, if you want to call it that, is maintained for those generations to follow. Not on our watch. We don't want to see the fisheries and the environment plunge into despair. We want to make it better for those that follow us.
Brendan is also the chair of the East Otago Taiapiri, a customary protection area that stretches 22 kilometres along the Otago coast. It doesn't extend far out to sea, about a kilometre and a half at its widest point. We're actually looking at it now from a headland high above the waves.
Ah, that's just up the road from me. I'm in Ōtaputi, Dunedin, and Pukitaraki Marae is by the beautiful coastal village of Karatani. It's one of the hapu of the Naitahu or Kaitahu iwi, the principal iwi of Te Wai Pounamu. And a taiapiri is one of these protection tools, right?
Yeah, a taiapiri allows all types of fishing, but has bylaws and regulations that have been recommended by the local community, not just Māori, and then approved by the Minister of Oceans and Fisheries. For example, right now in the East Otago Taiapiri, there are bans on set netting and taking pawa and kelp, and bag limits on finfish and shellfish. There's another type of customary protection area called a mātaitai, which allows customary and recreational but not commercial fishing. Again, bylaws are suggested by local tangata tiaki based on what they can see happening on the ground. Further up the coast, I catch up with University of Otago Marine Science Professor Chris Hepburn at the Mauraki Mātaitai. He's been involved in some of the surveying that's informed the local management of the area, including a current rahui, or closure, on collecting pawa in some parts.
We did 7 days of diving on this thing with a big team, and we counted and measured pawa at these different sites at different depths. We probably measured perhaps 3,000 or 5,000 pawa and found that the size in this area are very small, they're under the legal size limit. And so that empowered the tangtiaki to make a bylaw and close the area to allow the fishery to restore.
For a time, Chris was a member of the Southeast Marine Protection Forum. It was established in 2014 with the task of providing recommendations on a network of marine protected areas for the southeast of the South Island, an area where none currently exist. Chris was there to represent marine sciences.
We were trying to capture all of the different habitat types, soft sediment, deep reef, shallow reef, different components, so we get a representative picture of this area. That was the primary goal. And then after we identified some of the areas that probably gave us the most from a biodiversity perspective of a range, because we were really trying to get integrated places that included different habitat types and were large, and that was the first goal. So we went and proposed some different things. There were some ideas around, say the Nuggets, which is a previous marine reserve process, Shag Point, which is just the coast, Matakaya, was another one that was suggested.
Are these ones that are not in the final proposal now?
No, they're not. And the reasons for that is the community didn't want them.
But the key thing is where you put it.
Really good design is so important. If you don't design a marine reserve well, you're not going to get any benefits. If fishing isn't the main stressor in your system, a marine reserve won't do anything. So that's something people... Oh, let's have a marine reserve here. Well, there's a massive plume of sediment coming out right into this bay and no one's actually fishing that area. Well, go put your efforts somewhere else where fishing is an issue and there'll be some benefits around that stuff. So many, many benefits. And we talked when I was involved with this for hours and hours and hours, and we got thousands of submissions in supporting marine reserves and others opposing it. But in the end, we've seen the values. In the south, we don't have them. And those models that come from the north, we want to understand what closing a fishery here long-term means. Are there going to be the same benefits?
His experience on the forum highlights some of the difficulties of juggling competing interests. For example, commercial fishers.
What they might say is, well, that particular spot is an area where we can catch this size crayfish for this market at this time of the year. So therefore, when you do that, you take away 30% of our fishery. So that's sort of... the other side of it, we could talk about this till the cows come home, but that would be their point of view, and it's logical. It's not illogical. And personally, I'd say, well, based on the marine reserves we have, I don't think it's a major issue. But if we went around the corner and took to a commercial fisher, he might want to hit me. I'm not sure how popular I am here, but You know, that's the thing. As a community member involved in that forum, they're not our marine reserves, because I wouldn't have chosen that. I'd have a bloody big marine reserve off Shag Point. It'd be great. You know, there'd be a beautiful place for a marine reserve, Long Point down in the Catlins. And then you start getting these arguments, thin end of the wedge, you know, that argument, lack of trust.
Thin end of the wedge as in, like, you put in a couple of marine reserves and you're just going to want more and more and more of them.
It's the worst argument that anyone ever can bring to the table, but that people bring it to the table. We don't trust you.
The forum couldn't come to an agreement. It delivered two different proposals to the Ministers of Conservation and Fisheries in 2018.
After 3 years of work, weeks of tough debate, and crunching through a record 2,800 submissions, no one could say the Southeast Marine Protection Forum did not try hard. Yet in the end, nearly everyone is unhappy. The ministers say they'll consider the report carefully and consult the public again before any decisions are made.
And in October 2023, the Minister of Conservation announced six new marine reserves for the area, encompassing close to 400 square kilometres, which represents 0.2% of our territorial sea and 0.01% of our exclusive economic zone.
We have responded to the calls of 30 years of advocacy for marine protection, 10 years of, you know, important work that's gone in from the communities.
It's part of a global treaty to safeguard 30% of the oceans by 2030, but just getting here has been an agonising journey.
They are due to be surveyed and confirmed soon. DOC says the process should be completed by mid-2024. And they'll cover a range of habitats.
The marine reserves that have been proposed are very diverse and they're quite large. One's on a canyon, there's one near the mouth of the Waitaki River, there's one just south of us here that's a kelp forest ecosystem. There's one that's on the beaches around Dunedin. They're very different, and they're going to have very different benefits. Probably one of the jewel in the crown of these reserves that are coming in is the Green Island Reserve, because I've dived that site a lot. I can see over the last 20 years the depletion that's occurred, and I can see massive benefits for that.
Kaitahu are on board, but for them it's not the perfect solution.
We came together on this process because we thought it would work. It did work, and our commitment was to follow that through and to have these reserves introduced. We won't do that again under the current legislation.
That was Upoko customary leader Edward Ellison on the day of the announcement. And Brendan Flack agrees.
I guess my biggest concern would be that we don't do anything, and then when it's gone we think, gee, I wish we'd, you know, had been able to. And so I guess time will tell on that one, won't it?
Mm. Yeah. Do you mean that we've got to take these imperfect measures because it's better than doing nothing?
Yeah. In this case, for Ngaito, you know, we've got everything to lose, essentially. And we've shown that we understand that it, you know, something needs to be done. We're prepared to, you know, take a hit, for want of a better phrase. But it needs to be on our terms as well. And I think, you know, others need to take a hit.
Who are the others that need to take
a hit? Well, commercial and recreational fishers. Those that use it have a responsibility to, you know, to actually maintain it forever. The systems are imperfect. You know, we've got fisheries regulations in place for the whole country, really. And you'd be an optimist to say that, you know, that those are working.
These latest reserves are the classic standard type we've had, with some additional provisions that have been included to recognise the customary rights of kaitahu. This is to allow continued access to the reserves so they can teach their young people. Something Brendan's particularly excited about.
I think it would be awesome to be able to go out here in a canoe that you've built with a hook that you've made and catch a fish. You put it back, yeah. Because, I mean, you can go to Pack and Save, can't you, you know. But wouldn't that be cool, you know. And you can't do that in a fishery that's so depleted. So, I mean, that's not something that's going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen in my generation, but it may be that it's something that, you know, our mokos can access in the future, because I'm concerned that the only information they'll have around fishing is, you know, in books and, you know, old podcasts or stories, interviews.
Sitting in the archiving our taonga,
yeah. but if they could actually go out and exercise that and do what their ancestors did, that would be a win for this area anyway. you need your kaitiaki, you need your young people to be able to access those fisheries or whatever it is, those resources, those mahinga kai, and then it'll have importance to them and they'll actually, you know, fight for its health.
And Kaitahu will be closely involved in managing the reserves in partnership with DOC.
And I think there's a place for that conservation, but also there's a place for people in there as well. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be extractive. It can be having opportunity to assess the effectiveness of a closed area. So, the people who, as I say, are most affected by whatever decisions, they're actually actively involved in the restoration. It's no different to the riparian planting that we do on the land. You know, it's just a natural connection to the ocean, and you know, there's plenty of really neat things that you can do to understand the marine environment better. And I think, as marine protection evolves and we look at, generational review and all that, it doesn't necessarily close a fishery forever. But, you know, that's legislation that's beyond what I can speak to.
What does he mean, generational review?
Well, this is a potential new way of thinking about reserves, that you would maybe set a space aside for, say, 20 years, but then after that time you'd review it, see how it's doing. Maybe it's doing okay and you can allow some fishing to happen again. But also what Brendan mentioned there about the equivalent of riparian planting, maybe there's a new way too where, rather than lock it up and leave it, reserves could be actively managed, giving people a chance to remain connected to and in conversation with these places.
Can we do that under the current Act? Or does that just allow the lock it up and leave it kind of reserve?
Yeah, that's why both Edward and Brendan mentioned the legislation. Really, that 1970s Act just isn't fit for purpose anymore. We need a new, overarching Marine Protection Act that considers Te Tiriti o Waitangi and Māori rights, but that also reflects the new reality that we're in. Some areas of our ocean might need active restoration to remove invasive seaweeds, for instance, address kinnibarrens, maybe replenish with baby pawa grown in hatcheries, rather than just lock up and leave. In the meantime, people are trying to do workarounds. That was the idea with a proposed bespoke act to create a 620,000 square kilometre marine protected area around the Kermadec Islands. That would have represented 15% of our ocean, a great start towards meeting those international goals.
I hope that one day the Kermadecs will be an ocean sanctuary so that long after we are all gone, it remains pristine and untouched.
But mid last year, iwi organisations voted against supporting it. And Oceans and Fisheries Minister Shane Jones has just announced the bill will be withdrawn and it definitely won't go ahead.
We're not going to have the Kermadecs commandeered by a whole lot of test tube watching white coat scientists.
There's also a Hauraki Gulf Marine Protection Bill in the works, another bespoke piece of legislation. It's in response to the continued, well-documented decline of the state of the Gulf.
The ecosystem is facing multiple threats, such as overfishing, excessive sediment and nutrient runoff, and catastrophic climate changes. Seabirds are starving, mussels are drowning in mud, and tropical sea urchins are moving into the area.
It outlines 19 new marine protection areas within the Gulf. Two are extensions to existing marine reserves, 12 are high protection areas, which will allow certain kinds of Māori customary fishing, and 5 are seafloor protection areas designed to stop bottom trawling and other bottom-impacting gears. Public submissions on it closed last November, and for transparency, the publisher of New Zealand Geographic actually submitted in support of this bill. It's not yet clear whether it's going to make it through Parliament. So yeah, it might not be easy. But this is something we really need to figure out how to talk to each other about and find a way to solve.
We've got a long way to go, but we're trying. I'm positive about many things. I'm perhaps quite worried about, climate change and warming oceans. But, we just need to work hard and manage our fisheries, our marine environment better.
This episode was reported by freelance science journalist Kate Evans for New Zealand Geographic. Kate's feature on this goes into a lot more depth than we could cover in this podcast, and I highly recommend a read of it. It's called Taking on Water, and you can find it at nzgeo.com/seas. Thanks to the people Kate spoke to, Quentin Bennett, Brendan Flack, and Professor Chris Hepburn.
Voice of Tangaroa is a joint production between RNZ's Our Changing World and New Zealand Geographic. New Zealand Geographic reporting on the Voice of Tangaroa is public interest journalism funded through New Zealand On Air. This episode was produced by Kate and me, Claire Kincannon, with help from Ellen Rikers, Brianna Juretich and Phil Vine. Sound engineering was by William Saunders, and executive producers are Tim Watkin of RNZ and James Frankham of New Zealand Geographic. Original music for this series was created by Greens. Tēnā koe I whakarongo mai. Thanks so much for listening. Ko Claire Kincannon ahau, mā te wā.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.